Welcome to Smaller Narratives for a Larger World, brought to you by IASH, Binghamton University's Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities. I'm your host, Cole DePew, and today we're talking to Leslie Haywood about the human myth. Leslie is a powerful writer, scholar, and human being, and we get into evolution, speciesism, her heartbreaking loss of her son Drake, and so much more. Without further ado, here's our show. Hey everyone, I'm here with Leslie. And we are going to talk about a bunch of amazing stuff. She was my professor for a while in animal studies and one of my amazing mentors and an amazing creative nonfiction writer and poet. So hello, Leslie. Do you want to introduce yourself a little bit to the audience?
Okay. Hi, Cole. Thank you so much for having me here. This is going to be really fun to do.
Yeah,
I've been professor of English and creative writing here for forever at Binghamton University. Like you said, I do poetry and creative nonfiction. I mostly teach creative nonfiction, and that's really the genre I love and identify with most, I think, just because it involves so much everything. Like, you have to be able to think about, you have to be able to figure your life out to write it well. And I think that's a requirement that some of the other genres don't necessarily have. So it's always a wonderful, I don't know, every semester, I've never had a semester where students didn't end up, you know, coming out of there so excited because they had figured out something about their lives, about themselves that they hadn't before. And, you know, that's kind of, what interests me about writing. So, also, though, like, I really years ago started to be really interested in the sciences because I had never really had that as part of my formal academic training. My PhD is in critical theory. And especially at the time when I got it, which was the early 1990s, it was very, very insistent that everything was linguistic that was important. You know, all that matters was words. Words were how we construct meaning. Therefore, language was the only thing that was important to look at or study. And when I was presenting my dissertation topic in front of my committee, which was on anorexia and modernism, they were kind of like very uneasy because the idea that I was actually looking at like a real disease and real bodies and not just linguistic constructs. And I remember them kind of being like, oh, well, okay, but just don't be too empirical. And I've always had the drive to be precisely empirical as well as, you know, looking at language and symbols and all of that. So I kind of put myself back to school and started taking classes in the biology department. This was in the early 2000s. And, you know, really tried to learn everything kind of that that the critical theory PhD had left out. So the animal studies class, I think, really comes out of that background and actually comes out of my interest over the years. You know, everything, I've been a really serious athlete my whole life. Physical training has been an absolutely crucial part of my life. And again, that was something that was kind of left out of the, you know, the English humanities model. It was very strange. People thought that I would write about bodybuilding or want to talk about, you know, women in sports and female athletes. And that's been kind of the focus of my academic work. And so, you know, yeah, it all comes in together in terms of the way the body has been left out of any kind of academic analysis in the humanities, even when we were explicitly focusing on the body, the actual physiology was completely left out. One of the other things I'm really interested in is kind of the intergenerational transmission of trauma.
Oh, cool.
And that is where you absolutely have to take our physiological evolutionary history and the manifestations of that in the current day. You have to take that into consideration before anything. And when I was thinking about that this morning, when I was thinking about kind of what we were going to talk about, I realized like all my favorite books are exactly about this. And I didn't really, my favorite novels.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah. And I didn't realize that, like Toni Morrison's Beloved.
Uh-huh.
And I just look back at that today. I'm like, oh my God, like this is all the stuff I've been talking about in animal studies. This is, it's all right here, you know? So, and I hadn't really realized that. And I also love Louise Erdrich, in particular, the Master Butcher's Singing Club. And then there's a novel called Animal Dreams by Barbara Kingsolver. So it's like all my favorite books are really kind of about, you know, the animal in what is supposedly human and all of those aspects, you know, of ourselves that the Western tradition has always disavowed. So that's me.
That is so cool. I love all of those topics, and I have a bunch of questions, but I think we'll just kind of go off of the last point. So this story of people and of the myth of humanity, everyone knows that photo of the ape who slowly starts to stand up and turns into a white guy. Barring that some monolithic god didn't, you know, create us from clay, how is this image of the people, and you can explain it a little better, I think, just that it's supposed to show a sequence of evolution and progress, I guess. But can you talk a little bit about that image and what might work with it, what doesn't, what is it trying to say, or what does it say?
Absolutely.
Cool.
I use that in animal studies every semester.
Yeah.
You know, for the reason of what it shows about the misconceptions, first of all, about evolution, which there's a common misnomer that evolution is a progressive process, that involves progression from one form to the next, and each form is better than the next. So there's that evaluative judgment that somehow got attached to it actually early on. So when Darwin was writing and first came up with the theory of evolution, it was appropriated by a sociologist named Herbert Spencer.
Oh, okay.
And he was responsible for social Darwinism. And kind of the misnomers that people have about evolution today all come from Herbert Spencer, because he appropriated what Darwin said about evolution and welded it to the kind of 19th century, late Victorian progress narrative, which was racist, classist, sexist, everything. And he really appropriated what Darwin was saying to support those kinds of social inequalities. So the idea of evolution as progress is really attributable to him, and it's not what Darwin said at all. So for Darwin and, you know, later evolutionary biologists, evolution is a series of random mutations. Mm-hmm. It's random. It has no idea of progress. It's all an individual organism's response to their environment, right? Mm-hmm. And adaptations that allow them to live better within their particular environment, and then populations on the population level as well. So it has absolutely nothing to do with progress, everything to do about adaptation to a particular context. So that famous slide really follows the Spencerian model of evolution, which is scientifically incorrect. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of shows this mutation from kind of animal walking on all fours to, you know, progressively standing up, and the body becomes gendered as it quote unquote progresses. And there's this upward stance. It becomes a male body. It becomes a white body. And so you can see kind of the whole constellation of assumptions and images that we're really fighting against in this current historical moment, I think, in that particular slide. Because you see how the idea that some life forms are better than others is completely embedded in that progress narrative, right? And scientifically speaking, no one life form is better than another. And it's all those evaluative hierarchies that we're still struggling with and that still, you know, are the basis of, you know, all the oppositions, you know, between human, animal, black, white, male, female, self, other, all of those oppositions, which have been used to categorically define it as one group, as, you know, categorically different from and superior to. And, you know, so the white man standing upright becomes this, you know, the apex of development or civilization or the human is, and that becomes the standard. So, and it's all based on, you know, a kind of historical ideology that was scientifically disproven, you know, it was actually never part of the science. So when Darwin also gets blamed a lot for being, you know, so he gets confused with Spencer, kind of, if people don't really haven't read his work and don't know what he actually said. Even within the humanities a lot, there's this misnomer that, oh, Darwin was responsible for social Darwinism when he just wasn't.
Yeah, I think one of the parts that gets mistranslated a lot is the survival of the fittest idea.
Which came from Spencer. Yeah. Those are Herbert Spencer's words. Darwin never said that.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like evolution becomes a form of conquest.
Right.
And
right.
That's so interesting. So could you talk a little bit, I mean, people know about racism, they know about sexism. Could you talk about speciesism and why it's important?
Yeah, I think that is kind of an intricately related category. Mm-hmm. It comes from the same sets of assumptions that racism and classism and sexism come from. So just instead of male, female, white, black, instead it's a human animal. And it's based on, you know, us forgetting that we are animals, right? And it's so much, so one of the, I know you, we talked about this a little bit when you asked me to speak on this for this podcast. And one of the main kind of areas that's really developing in animal studies right now, I think, is specifically focused on how we have, you know, disavowed the animal within us in order to set ourselves apart from. And all of the reasons why we need to, instead of disavowing and projecting the animal elsewhere, we need to own that. And that, you know, the only way we're going to solve the issues that seem almost insurmountable right now, everything to do with climate change and pandemics and species extinctions and, you know, everything that's happening all around us, there's an emerging branch of animal studies that really says, okay, you know, the only way we're going to be able to deal with this is to own the animal in ourselves and stop pretending that we're these detached, you know, these detached brains floating out in space somewhere that's going to go colonize Mars, you know, that we can just separate from everything that's animal within us. And which I'm probably jumping ahead a little bit with your questions, but when you disavow the animal, you project it on another group.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way racism is inculcated.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way sexism is inculcated. That's the way classism is inculcated.
Yep.
The other is always animal.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the animal is always animal, right? And so much work is now on how there's multiple intelligences. Like, so mm-hmm. for you know, until very, very recently, intelligence was defined as a human quality.
Yeah.
You know, animals didn't have intelligence. There was no other form of intelligence but human. But recently, there's been so much work on how there are multiple intelligences, and even if they don't, you know, function exactly like our own, they are forms of intelligence. And there's no way to say ours is better than theirs. So like my octopus teacher,
I have to watch that. You're like,
yeah, oh, you do. It's so amazing.
Oh, cool.
And it's a really good example and very moving documentary. And it's based on a book that shows, you know, how what another intelligence looks like,
mm-hmm.
you know, what it's like to experience that. And so, you know, there's multiple intelligences, there's multiple kinds of language. There's not just human language, there's different kinds of language. So it's almost like breaking that down, like the idea that the human is the standard for everything, and that human means separate from and different than everything that's animal or material or bodily. That's really where we need to start.
From that cultural perception, because I totally agree, you know, human, I grew up thinking, you know, humans were the best. And just growing up in America, you know, you kind of subconsciously believe that guys are the best, white are the best, right?
Yeah.
You know, you can't really help it. Growing up feeling that way, especially like I'm a white guy, you know, all the presidents are white and everything. And that was normal, until like for me as, you know, my perspective of that being ignorant of a lot of, other people's experiences. I lived in a majoritively white town, middle to upper class in Connecticut. And you know, I never questioned why the town over in Danbury had a ton of people of color living in worse conditions with worse schools. You know, we never asked that, you know, this arbitrary right. town line. And it wasn't until, you know, I was older that I started to ask these questions and find, you know, a little bit of, pain and ignorance and discomfort. And, you know, I think sometimes it's hard to admit that. And I definitely am uncomfortable talking about it to a degree, but I think it is important to do it sensitively. But you bring up so many cool points. I was just thinking, like, I'm right now in a basement with zero windows, with artificial light.
Yeah.
There is a photo of some impressionist field behind me, which is like really helpful. But I just wanted to know, like, what are we giving up when we do identify as, you know, we identify more with technology and computers rather than, you know, the forest or other animals? Like, what are we losing here? What am I losing being in this basement at the moment?
You are losing. Let me find this. So I mentioned this book to you that I'm using in animal studies for the first time this semester. It's by a writer named Melanie Challenger,
uh-huh.
and it's called How to Be Animal.
Cool.
And it's one of the most moving and articulate representations of that movement I'm talking about in the field, which is saying, you know, okay, we have to take on, stop projecting our animal on everything mm-hmm. else, and you know, own it and love it. And then I found it, when I went back to Beloved today, I found several passages that were saying exactly the same thing. So Morrison's writing about this, you know,
uh-huh.
way back in, when was Beloved published?
80s.
Something. It was somewhere in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like late 80s, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, she was there way ahead of this movement in animal studies.
You got to love like how-to guides for things that we already are. Like, you can't not be animal.
Right.
Either, right?
It's crazy. No, yeah. It's crazy to think that we can't.
Yeah.
And this, okay, so here I found what
Good.
What she was talking about and what you're missing in your basement. She says, many of the things we most value are relationships, the romantic sensations of attraction and love, pregnancy and childbirth, the pleasures of springtime, of eating a meal, our physical, largely unconscious, and demonstrably animal. The things we most want to avoid, suffering, humiliation, loneliness, pain, disease, death, are born of animal instinct and the shared needs of an organism. Human life may be a blend of biology and dreams, but these dreams are still animal dreams. They are not separate to the bodies from which they arrive. It's nonsense that our gifts have made us something that isn't animal.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So she's really talking about how we can't disavow these things because they're actually what's most meaningful to us as a species. And at the same time, it's not just that we can't disavow them, but the reason why we're disavowing them in the first place is because we're afraid.
Right.
Right? Because these are exactly the things about us that make us vulnerable. These are exactly the things about us that make us subject to everything. You know, an organism is subject to mortality, death, you know. And so kind of in our technological fantasies, you know, we're trying to protect ourselves. And that also comes from our animal fears, you know, our survival instincts, right? So it's kind of, you know, it's animal all the way down, no matter what stories we tell ourselves.
It reminds me a lot of how much effort it takes as a society, because this does feel like very much a societal thing, orchestration. You know, we do it. I think there's a lot of social cost to not doing something like this, like not bathing or, I don't know, acting the way you want to in a meeting or something. But we do like things at a larger scale, too. Like I feel like we hide death and sickness really well. So with hospitals and nursing homes and then mental illnesses with psychiatry wards and
or even any negative emotions, right?
Right,
we're all expected to post these delusional, you know, happy only narratives of ourselves on social media. And if we do otherwise, we're chastised.
Mm-hmm. I had a student today present on FOMO, which is the fear of missing out. Which is such a awesome and terrible phenomena. But basically, you know, everyone goes out every night because they're afraid not to, because they want to show out on social media. And if they don't go out, they'll just see how awesome of a time it was on social media. But
what they're seeing isn't actually what happened
right.
at all.
But yeah, we were talking about how, like, have you ever been at a party and someone takes out their Snapchat and pans the room and everyone goes from being bored to like rocking out, and how that's kind of like trying to play into this FOMO idea. But she offered a really cool alternative. She called it JOMO, which was the joy of missing out.
Oh yeah.
I love basically not doing anything and being okay with that. But
yeah,
I don't know. Do you have anything to say about that? Like, that denial of animality in society, like, how does that feel to you? I mean, for someone who knows all of this stuff, I mean, you're probably still participating in it. It's really hard to escape.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I have friends who make fun of me when I start, you know, going off on these things.
Yeah.
One in particular who's always calling me out and saying, oh, well, yeah, well, can you survive out there? Do you know how to make a fire, you know, like just, you know, by rubbing sticks together? Can you survive without, you know, all your luxuries that you have? You know, what about your SUV? You know, everything, you know, that protects you. And yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really... The minute you get like caught in a storm or, you know, kind of, you know, when the power goes out and, you know, kind of, you lose your phone, you lose your access to anything and everything. And it's so like our infrastructure is so vulnerable.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can just lose it in a moment. Like everything that protects us, everything that hides us from, you know, our animal vulnerabilities, it's also so vulnerable. And we don't even think about it until it happens. You know, it just is, it's one of those things where, you know, we're so conditioned to believe, okay, you know, to live in, you know, the developed country that's the United States, you know, we automatically, you know, deserve this, and this, you know, we don't ever have to worry about any kind of, you know, threats to our physical well-being. And that's just such a, you know, that's such a privileged kind of isolated, you know, like ridiculous point of view to have, because right, you know, right outside the window, you know, there's the latest crisis that's going to plunge us right into the middle of, you know, the same thing, you know, other people that don't have the same kind of privileges suffer with all the time.
Mm-hmm. I live in a new apartment. It's not a new apartment. It's new to me. And we don't, our heating is really temperamental. So it turns off in the middle of the night and then comes back on in the morning. So like this morning it was 60 degrees in my room and I'm like all grumpy about this. And, and I live with three cats and they're kind of fine. Like I got to admit, they don't complain a lot. One of them more than the others, but, yeah, I don't know. I've recently been, we rescued a dog, and he actually has a history of being abused and of biting. And recently he actually bit a few of my family members, not pretty seriously. And we've had to have really tough conversations about what to do. But I was talking to my little brother who has volunteered at rescue shelters.
Who adopted the dog?
Oh, me and my wife. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought you were gonna go like, who rescued who? Remember the, you know, those bumper stickers?
But this happened when you were visiting your family.
Yeah, it happened like last weekend. My wife is there right now, and we're actually in the midst of this conversation. Of, you know, euthanasia has been brought up as a, you know,
no,
right? I know, but that's like, no. That's kind of the thing that gets brought up. But,
and why is that always the case? So when humans bite, you know, when right. humans, you know, like lash out at other humans, like that's never a question. Like, oh, we're going to euthanize you because, you know, you have an abuse history and you're acting out, you know, out of that because you don't feel safe. I mean, it just don't ever bring that question. You know, it's just you can't do that to the dog.
No. And we're
not. You have to do training.
Yeah.
You have to do training and you have to do everything you can to only put the dog in situations where he or she feels safe, because that's where that's coming from.
Yeah.
They don't bite unless they feel threatened.
It's fear. Yeah. So my brother, he said, what is he? Oh, he said, yeah, the problem with these dogs is that they can't speak. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, or we can't listen.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, and you mentioned
they are speaking.
Yeah, they are, and like you said, there's fear. And I don't know. I mean, you mentioned earlier about talking, and you know, we can talk, so like that's rationality. But animals can talk too.
Yeah.
And we don't know how to listen, or we don't want to, right?
Exactly. It's both. I think, or we haven't thought of it. We haven't, because we've been so busy, you know, thinking what Mark Beckoff, remember his book, you know, where he was talking about how in anthropocentrism we act as if we're the only show in town, and
yes.
we gotta you know, stop thinking that human qualities and the way we see things and our perspective is the only thing that exists, you know, and that, you know, yeah, we're not listening because we don't consider these other things language. Mm-hmm. We don't consider them to be based in the very same things that we ourselves are driven by, right? So, you know, what contributes to a human fight? What contributes to human forms of biting? It's the same exact thing for the dog. When you have an abuse history, you are wired to defend yourself if you feel threatened.
Yeah.
You know, either that or the freeze response where you just shut down.
Can you talk a little bit about fear and what that does to the body, the human body in particular?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of my favorite subjects.
Okay. You're talking about it a little right there.
So, in animal studies, I always use, as you know, Stephen Porges and Jaak Panksepp, the polyvagal theory and effective neuroscience. And what Porges's work shows is how our neurophysiology really precedes any other reaction that we have mm-hmm. to the world. So that long before the process of perception, we have what's called neuroception. And we're evolutionarily wired in three different levels. And the most recent adaptation is the social engagement system, right? Mm-hmm. And that is kind of what is default online for us. We're chill, we're walking around, everything's okay. But if we detect anything, because we're still wired to detect any kind of threat, any kind of danger, if we neuroceive that kind of threat, immediately social engagement system gets cut off and we're thrown into fight, flight, or freeze, mm-hmm. right? So one of the main things that's happening in this particular cultural moment is that everybody's in fight, flight, or freeze all the time because yeah. nobody doesn't feel threatened. Like mm-hmm. everything around us is threatening. It's really hard to be in that most evolutionarily recent state of rest and digest where you can socially mm-hmm. engage with other people, where you feel safe. So, you know, you can reach out and have a pleasant conversation, right? It's like we have to feel safe in order for any of that to happen. And we're threatened very easily, just like animals are threatened very easily. That's part of our evolutionary heritage. That's what allowed all of us to survive. Mm-hmm. And those mechanisms have been preserved for a reason. There are still lots and lots of threats, you know, to our safety. Again, even though we want to tell ourselves all the time, no, you know, we've transcended all that. We haven't. And it's almost like you have to know there's stuff to be scared of and go ahead and act decent anyway. You know, it's almost like, and that was in Beloved too. there's kind of the character that speaks a lot of the truth in the novel is Baby Suggs. And she says, you know, you gotta know that these terrible things are out there. Know it and go, she says. And this is, you know, this is in the context of the extreme racism that one of the main characters, you know, is experiencing. Mm-hmm. And she's just telling her, look, you know, this is what it is. And you got to know it and go out there anyway. And that's a very specific and important situation that we can't just appropriate because it's much more concentrated in that context. But it is applicable to everything. You know, it's anybody's reaction to fear. It's just some of us are threatened a lot more than others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fear is just so much in the body, not necessarily in the brain. I mean, as those are not separate things by any means, but
yeah, the brain is a part of the
right,
body.
Right, I know. You're so there I go.
Like to think it's like this separate thing.
I am not and my body.
Gorgeous, okay. Like gorgeous and tanks. Kind of show those connections, right?
Yeah.
So how we get from what's going on with our heart rate, how we get from what's going on with, you know, the rate of our breathing to how we actually act. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, our bodily states determine whether or not we're able to process anything cognitively.
Right. Right? Yeah, you can't listen or learn if you're not feeling safe because you're on, yeah. you know, a high alert. So I'm trying to reconcile the fact that we need fear evolutionarily to survive. It's very important to be afraid of certain things. Granted, we've probably evolved to be afraid of more acute threats rather than like a news feed or a Twitter feed. But I do see
those same buttons, but those same buttons are being pushed.
Can you explain?
So even though like a news feed or a Twitter feed isn't kind of in your face, it isn't mm-hmm. the same thing as having, you know, a gun put to your head.
Right.
It still triggers the fear. It's a chronic trigger. Instead of being acute, instead of being, you know, really intense and you know, making you go into that crazy state right away, which is what happens in the context of an acute threat, it's chronic. Okay. It's constant. It's always there. So we're always slightly aroused, always slightly uneasy, always slightly like not at ease, always slightly on the defensive, you know. So that's our current moment. I notice that nobody can talk to each other anymore.
I mean, it's hard. Like you said, it's hard to generate thoughts. It's hard not to be extremely defensive and sensitive when you're not feeling very comfortable. So you mentioned these threats, these global threats of climate change and the pandemic, and how disconcerting that is to all of a sudden, like the air you breathe. Like I remember becoming extremely hyper aware of air when COVID came to whatever my town. You can't see it, so it sucks because you can't see it. So it's everywhere. It's nothing. And all of a sudden, like something in my lungs, which is supposed to give me life, was threatening me.
Yeah.
And then similarly, this summer in Western New York, we had just a day or two of smoke from the California and Western Canadian wildfires.
Yes.
And that, you could actually see that.
Yeah.
And the threat I felt from that was I was so angry and I felt so powerless. And I mean, I could connect it to the resilience you were talking about of getting through all of that, but it's just, it's very agitated. And where can we go to feel okay? Do we need to escape? Do I need to just make up a new reality? Like, that's pretty tempting. I guess that's what virtual reality is for.
That is what's behind, you know, like the idea that we're going to colonize Mars. You know?
Right. Yeah.
You know, kind of some of the projects. Actually, I think you wrote about this, didn't you? Where some of the projects where people are trying to offload their
Neuralink.
Their consciousness
I'm all into that conversation. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. You download.
So that's coming from the same place, right? Yeah, that's true. You know. So it's, yeah, the human mind is very good at making up stories, right?
Yeah.
And that's what we do when we're scared too. And, you know, it's just some stories are function better as maybe actual solutions than others.
Do you want to talk a little bit about your story, Precious But Not Human?
Sure.
Can you give us some background on that just for people who have no idea? And I'll put a link in for that. So people can read it because it's one of the most moving things. And I actually read it before I met you when I was going to take your class and I was looking up some of your work. And I'll never forget it. It was really, really tough and beautiful. So, yeah, if you don't mind, could you chat about that for a second? Sure.
So I wrote that as a part of this series that the Center for Humans and Nature has, and it was part of the series on what it means to be human.
Yeah.
And I think I chose to write about that particular incident in my life because it was the moment when I was most confronted with those kinds of ethical questions and literal life and death realities. Mm-hmm. So, My first child was born he suffered hypoxia, and I was in labor for 4 days. he suffered hypoxia when he wasn't born in time. So hypoxia is not getting enough oxygen to the brain. I was at a birth center run by midwives and probably didn't get to the hospital fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
And who, you know, who's to say, like, I don't know who was really at fault. It was kind of this situation that happened. part of it was my fault because I was insisting on having a natural birth. And, mm-hmm. you know, and of course the midwives really believe in that. And there's a, you know, number of great arguments for that. But in my particular situation, I needed the medical intervention. Mm-hmm. So after 4 days of labor, my son was born, with basically like he was alive, but his brain was pretty much gone. Mm-hmm. You know, 'cause just when you don't get oxygen, it kills off the brain. So he was never going to, he would have been blind, deaf, dumb, wouldn't have been able to move, wouldn't have, you know, kind of would have been an inert body mm-hmm. lying there and developing, right, into like a teenager, but with no kind of consciousness, no kind of really, really anything. But he was strong. His body was strong, and he wouldn't, you know, he showed no signs of weakness at first. He was just alive and holding on to that.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we were being told, okay, you're going to have to prepare, you know, to live with this. And, you know, I was very vocal in saying I didn't think that was any kind of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that life as an abstract principle isn't enough to justify the resources and the labor and, you know, kind of the emotional labor, the physical labor, like everything that it would have taken to keep him alive. And, you know, the nurses were horrified by me. Mm-hmm. They thought I was just, you know, bad mother, you know, nightmare, you know, because how could I be saying this about my own child?
Yeah.
And it was literally like coming up in the face of, okay, so what is life? You know, what does it mean to have a life? And if you're not going to be able to even move, is that a life? And, you know, I really, you know, very strongly felt no, that isn't life. And we actually we were up at Strong Memorial Hospital up in Rochester, and mm-hmm. they had a whole ethics panel come in and,
oh, wow.
you know, kind of talk about the ramifications and I don't even remember kind of what the ethics committee's deliberation came to. But the primary doctor on the case, you know, was in agreement with us that, you know, this really isn't any kind of life, and we shouldn't take extraordinary measures to preserve it. So we took him off the life support. And he was still breathing for a while and, mm-hmm. you know, was still okay and was still fighting. And the horrible thing was he looked perfect.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You couldn't tell there was anything wrong mm-hmm. whatsoever. It's just that he couldn't move or anything. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't, you know, acting like an ordinary baby. So eventually after 16 days, he did, you know, actually let go. Mm-hmm. But going through that, and it just, you know, the next year was one of the worst of my life. It was just, just having to wrestle with all of that. And just, I don't know, it was just,
mm-hmm.
you know, was I wrong to think what I think? Was I a failure as a human being? Was I a failure as a mother? Like, was it my fault that, you know, I didn't, you know, go into the hospital and, you know, get a C-section earlier? You know, was it wrong? You know, was it something wrong in the midwife model? Like, it's just like going back and forth and back and forth about, you know, kind of how did this happen and who was at fault? And finally, I just had to realize, you know, look, you know, this is one of those limit cases. It's like mm-hmm. that nobody was at fault. This was something that happened. And, you know, it just, It's something I'll always live with. It's something I'll always remember. And it's something that really forced me to think about, what is a meaningful life and what are the parameters of it?
That is an incredible story. Thank you so much for sharing that. It's a big question, but what did you learn from that as far as what matters in life, human, non-human? Is there anything you took away from that?
It's funny because before I taught animal studies and had read the Jak Panksepp's work about the primary process emotions and how those kind of form a primitive kind of consciousness that is the raw material that our more developed, secondary and tertiary consciousness is. Before I had read that, I think I kind of really came from the more common point of view that, like, well, human means to have this very particular kind of consciousness, right? Where you have this metacritical capability and rationality is such a huge defining part. And, the other parts of us aren't important because all of our achievements come from, everything that's in the prefrontal cortex, right? our kind of rational capacities, our linguistic capacities, et cetera, et cetera. And like I said, I was really trained in that tradition in critical theory, but I always had doubts about it in my mind at the same time, because just my physical experiences over the years had really led me to know there must be something else too. And so once I found effective neuroscience and learned that there is this kind of primitive consciousness that informs the others, that made me really look back on what happened with Drake. His name was Drake. And think, did he have that? And if he had that, he wouldn't have developed to be human in the, fully conscious, cognitive, rational sense of human, but maybe he would have had that more basic sense of things. And I don't know. They didn't make that clear. If he had that, if he had that basic ability to feel, that basic ability to fear, to feel joy, to, I don't know. Nobody ever talked about that. They just said he's never developing. He's never, and he'd be blind. He won't be able to hear, he won't be able to turn himself over. But I wonder now. That's something that still haunts me. It's like, what if he could feel those basic feelings that I so strongly feel that's what's most important in us, right? So it's like, I think if I knew the answer to that, I may have thought differently about what happened. I don't know. So all I know is kind of what I learned from it was an acute sense of what the different parts of life are, and that, being human is this vastly complicated concatenation of different developmental stages and impulses in this intricate relationship between physiology and, then what later becomes thought, and where do you draw the line in that?
I think such a big part about this whole series of podcasts is I'm really kind of antagonizing the idea that defining human is a trap. So, like, you can say rational animal, but there's a million rational animals. Speaking animal, biped ape with a propensity for language. Like, why do we need to spend so much time making such a big difference to differentiate ourselves? Yeah. It's kind of exhausting. And I think in the moments of pain, of birth, death. I think those areas blur more than ever.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, and maybe, you know, I think Challenger's right. Like, those are the kind of experiences where we're most alive, where we're most human, and we're most animal. And it's because we're the most animal in those moments. So really, I think there's only that blurring. I really don't think there's any usefulness in maintaining human as a separate category as anything other than a species marker,
right?
Because we are our own species, just like elephants are their own species, and, you know, mosquitoes are their own species. Mm-hmm. But as an evaluative marker that says we have these capacities that nobody else says, it's like, well, elephants have these capacities that no other species has, and bats have, yeah, you know, capacities that no other species has. That's just a, you know, an empirical situation that's true of all species. And so we need to get rid of that evaluative sense, just like in the case of evolution, talking, you know, referring back to that earlier discussion about the slide, our sense of evolution has got to be more scientifically accurate, and we got to not see it in terms of progression and think of the human life form as, you know, this thing that has, you know, evolved out of simpler life forms into the most complex life form, because it's just not true.
There's so much we can learn from other species as well. Like, I haven't seen the octopus teacher, but my guess is that the person's learning from an octopus.
Yeah.
I mean, I mentioned my cats. I try to learn from them. This idea of patience and observation, listening. You know, they have it okay. One of them gets to go outside, but then he kills a bunch of like animals, and it's like,
I know, the
ethical dilemma of having cats is, and then I feed, I thank the chickens that were raised in a factory farm somewhere in Nebraska and swirled up into gravy in these cans that I feed them, you know, and I don't eat meat myself, but I feed my cats meat of horrifically treated animals, and we've tried buying local meat, but it's like that. It's really hard. It's so darn convenient to buy a can of Friskies or whatever, right, have it shipped from Amazon, and it's not real. It's, you know, it's not a real chicken. That chicken didn't have feelings, you know, it's so removed. But yeah, it's just such a balance.
You remember Panksepp's example of the chickens who respond to Mozart?
No, refresh me?
So one of his more famous experiments had to do with seeing if animals had musical appreciation, and he did all these experiments with chickens and found that like chickens absolutely love Mozart.
Nice.
and respond in all these different ways. Mm-hmm. I remember having a turtle that used to love Lady Gaga, and every time Lady Gaga would come up with like would come up on the rock and stick her head out, and you know, so it's just like, yeah, it's so problematic, and it's so but wait, I'm still stuck on the dog though, Cole.
Yeah, no, we're good.
We're getting along with the cats.
Yeah, he chases them, he nips at them. Two of them stick up for themselves pretty well, and they get along. One of our cats had heart failure, and she is a runt of the litter and very temperamental, like hates everything. So they don't get along, and he picks on her, of course. So there's a little cat and dog there, but I mean, I try to think of like, what's my role in this situation?
Oh, well, you kind of have to make everybody safe.
Yeah.
That's your role.
Yeah. And I put them in the same house, you know, so it's like kind of.
So where can you put the cat, the cat that's ill? Where can you give her own space where the dog
is?
Oh,
yeah. So we have one of our rooms is little cat doors. So we latch the door. So she has her safe spot, but she's so funny. What she wants to do is sit next close to him, but have him completely ignore her. And, but like, that just doesn't work that way. So, But yeah, so
children, they'll adapt eventually.
Yeah, yeah, they're so new. This is the situation's so new.
And the biting thing, you need to go to a dog trainer.
Yeah, we're gonna do that. We're gonna get a consultation with an animal behaviorist, and then bring them to training, and take it a lot slower. So I think we treated him.
Yeah, that's the thing. You have to be patient.
Very patient.
Okay, because it is an abuse history, and abuse history really it wires you so that the defensive mechanisms are the pathways in the brain that are most frequently used, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So it's got to be a lot of safety and time feeling safe.
Right.
That's necessary to rewiring those pathways so that the defense mechanism won't be triggered so quickly. It's the same thing as with PTSD in humans. Mm-hmm. It's the same exact thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think
it's a lot of patience, but it's worth it because then you've actually made somebody's world, you know, from a hell into something good, you know, where they can experience joy and bonding and all the positive affects instead of just the negative ones.
Yeah. I love that. And this is a really timely, conversation for me to have. Like you're the person I should have called from the get-go, to be honest, because it's just like the system for abused animals sucks so much. Like
oh god,
he didn't.
Well, for people too.
Oh, for sure.
For
I know
people too.
They're very
like
similar, right?
Finally in therapy is getting around to realizing that like having cognitive discussions doesn't work for everything, you know?
CBT, right?
You need somatically based therapies. Oh, you know, like how many years did it take for that to happen?
It reminds me of the idea that I'm in a basement with no windows, and I was studying like eco psychology over the summer, part of my reading list for the exam,
who did you read for that?
That's an aside.
Who did you read on eco-psychology?
I don't know. I'm not good with author names. It's on my list if you want to look.
Okay.
I think the title of the book is called, it's a collection of essays.
Okay.
So this one, it's like there's one on ecotherapy, but the moral of the story is like how they were saying how it's actually pathological. It's a disease to not be exposed to other than human species. So like they did studies where patients in hospitals that had a window showing the park, and even the park is like kind of a problematic idea. Like it's already a controlled version of, but whatever.
But it's something. It's a tree.
People, you know? And then the people without windows or windows showing like a concrete wall, the recovery rates are much higher for people who see the tree, who see the birds. And they got into how, like, why people bring flowers to people who are sick. And, like, it actually makes us feel so much better.
Yeah.
Why so many people want to live on the coastline.
Exactly.
You know, because we like to be near water. And it's so healing and healthy. And, like, living in this city with zero trees and bad air, it's actually pathological.
Absolutely.
But we can't recognize that if we don't understand that we are, you know, animals. And
animals, exactly.
First, we're not just, you know, computer chips we plug into our phones every morning. And
we are animals first. That's the thing. That's like we are animals first.
So I could go tree bathing to figure that. Have you ever heard of that? Tree bathing?
No.
Oh, it's like this therapy in Japan. You basically hang out in a forest for a while. And it just literally.
Well, see, I do that all the time anyway.
Yeah, but there's a cool word for it. So there you go.
It is.
Yeah.
Tree bathing. Okay, I'll have to remember that.
It's kind of gross, but really, it's kind of a weird word, but yeah.
We also did this other book on why an intersectionality between kind of like human rights discourse, animal rights discourse, environmental rights, like how they're all interconnected, and why instead of competing with each other, each of those kind of activist causes need to join together. And that's called Human Animal Earthling Identity.
Ooh, I love Earthling.
Which is a funny name, but like the book is really good.
Thank you all so much for listening. I really enjoyed this one. Our next guest is to be announced. So until then, peace.